Innovation Minds presents At the Edge, a podcast about using innovation to empower and drive engagement. The nature of work has changed. Companies around the world are struggling to find the right balance in the new work-from-home hybrid paradigm. As much of the workforce begins to go back to the office after more than a year working remotely, how can leaders keep their employees engaged and collaborating successfully? In this podcast, we interview thought leaders from business and hear their stories and viewpoints on how to use innovation to engage the workforce, as well as how to innovate engagement.
Innovation isn't this thing that is done, you know, occasionally by a few people in an ivory tower. It's something that's just part of your everyday life. That's really our goal. When we talk about creating a culture of innovation, lots of people talk about creating a culture of innovation. It's very hard to do. Takes a long time, typically. So what we feel is that this is a sort of a really interesting pathway to get there.
We are here with Doug Humphreys, the head of global sales for Innovation Minds, and a person with many, many years of experience in the innovation field. So, Doug, welcome, and thanks for being here with us.
Well, thanks, Michael.
Specifically, innovation at the edge. What does that mean to you? Why is it important? And why should it be something we care about?
So innovation at the edge will sort of, it'll be a little bit of an echo for people that talked about edge computing or, you know, when for the minute that edge computing was around. But the concept is that instead of having all the innovation done by very senior people at HQ in small teams and being really responsible for growth or for continuous improvement, innovation at the edge sort of pushes that capability and responsibility and authority for coming up with the new out to the workers, out to where the rubber meets the road, where people are interacting with customers, where people are interacting with vendors. And it's there that really the whole, for most brands, that's where really it all happens. Now, whether leadership and management has a really good handle on exactly what's happening out there, you know, that's a communications issue that goes back to my roots, right? It's like, are you getting good info? Are you hearing the right stories? Do you know what people are doing, what they're thinking? Do you know if some of your folks have a better way of doing it than the standard operating procedure? Do you know exactly what your customers think about your product or services or brand? By pushing those capabilities out to the people who are doing that work all day, every day, your chances of getting good information back around innovation, good information about what you could be doing, what you should be doing, is heightened. It's increased a lot. So at Innovation Minds, we're really focusing on this concept of innovation at the edge by creating a technology tool set that helps people do their everyday job. And by doing that, by helping them just do what they always do faster, better, they have a little extra time. They have what we call innovation is available to them. So when they have that idea or when they see that, make that observation about what's going on, they have a place to put it. They have something to do with it. They have a community of people who can comment on that and help them with it. And it can sort of work itself up into an idea, into an initiative, into a project. And all of a sudden, you know, innovation isn't this thing that is done, you know, occasionally by a few people in an ivory tower. It's something that's just part of your everyday life. And that's really our goal. When we talk about creating a culture of innovation, lots of people talk about creating a culture of innovation. It's very hard to do. Takes a long time, typically. So what we feel is that this is a sort of a really interesting pathway to get there.
What are the challenges that you've come across as you've seen of getting people to innovate?
You know, it's that old saw that, success has a thousand fathers, but failure is an orphan. And so, you know, what happens in the innovation space is that where you have management saying, oh, you know, feel free to fail. You know, we want you to fail fast, cheap, all that kind of stuff. That doesn't resonate with most people. Most people in high performing organizations are themselves high performers. They got A's. They did well. They got good scores. They went to good schools. They don't really like to fail. So it's not, you can say it, but until you've kind of created an environment that is experimental in nature, and until you truly lionize and shine a spotlight on the projects that didn't make it, you're not going to progress. So one of the things we've tried to do at Innovation Minds is really focus on that communication layer, focus on the recognition and the acknowledgement of just participation. So our belief is that a lot of, and this speaks very specifically to an area of innovation called the challenge, you know, the idea challenge methodology. And one of the drawbacks from my perspective, having watched this for years and years, is that many of those challenges are competitive in nature. They're designed to pit the different people or the different teams one against the other. Someone's going to win. Someone goes to the Shark Tank, you know, pitches their stuff to Mark Cuban. Everyone else loses. And that's okay. I mean, that's not inherently bad, but our feeling is that if you have everyone collaborating, everyone helping each other, all pulling together, you get a lot more value. And because we're all competitive by nature, we need to gamify something. So what we gamify is participation. Participation is what gets you the points. And so by acknowledging and shining a light on those innovation champions, if you will, we feel that's kind of a game changer. So if we're looking for a truly engaged workforce, people who really care about the values and the mission of the organization, let them be innovators. Don't take that away from them. We all like to be asked our opinion. Ask it and then acknowledge their response. Give them voice. They'll be engaged. Now you have now you're well on your way to that culture of innovation. There's a good story though that I have from it was actually Dow DuPont. This is quite some years ago, and they did a sort of a very broad challenge, and they really invited everyone, pretty much everyone in the company. So it wasn't just the scientists, wasn't just the R&D, just everyone. It was anyone and everyone. Everyone who had Dow at the end of their email was invited to do this. And they did this a few different times, and it kind of it was being successful. And they noticed that several of the projects rolled back to this one guy, and they were like, "Hey, this is kind of interesting. This guy is coming up with some really good stuff." And so they went down the roster to figure out where he was from, what he was doing, and it turned out he was working in the loading dock. And they were like, "Loading dock? What is going on there? How's this guy coming up with the stuff that's actually very, very technical?" It was sort of PhD chemistry stuff. And as it turned out, this person who was working there was a PhD chemist, and he'd gotten to sort of retirement age, but really didn't want to leave the company because he was so engaged with the brand and with the life and the people and his friends. So he just took a job in the loading dock. And he was the traffic cop for different stuff. And in his spare time, he would send these ideas in, and a couple of them got patented. So anyway, that was a great story. I just loved that. Which you wouldn't get that kind of submission of that kind of input if you didn't just push that to the entire organization, to the edge.
In most organizations, especially large ones, there's a lot of talent throughout the organization that's probably being ignored at most places.
Well, Michael, it's not just that it's ignored. You know, another thing that I say a lot is that when we just go to the people who have deep expertise in a particular area, there's a lot of bias that's inherent in that with respect to innovation. I like to say it's really hard to think out of the box if you designed and built the box. So the problem often is that if you have that kind of expertise, people have a very sort of they've got rigid notions of what can work and what can't work. You take someone who doesn't have that background, they don't know what they don't know. And so they go, well, why don't we do this? And the instant answer might be, you can't do that. That'll never work. But you take someone else who's not in the box either, who goes, oh, you know what? I saw an interesting technology over here. This might work. And all of a sudden you start to put together this really sort of, maybe a counterintuitive approach, but certainly a counter standard operating procedure approach, and you have an innovation. So, you know, getting those people who have a different look works. I'll tell you another story. I used to work at a firm that was an architectural consultancy, and one of the things we did is we used data to understand sort of work go or understand how we could better set up neighborhooding within the workplace, and sort of and how that impacted performance, human performance. And it was fascinating with respect, and you could dial this to different values, but if the value that you were looking for was innovation, it was very important that you created points of interaction between people that were from different groups, different functions, different business units. And if you could, and so it wasn't always the most, it wasn't necessarily optimal to create working spaces that were the most quote unquote efficient as far as getting people from their cars to where they were going to sit to the, you know, to the dining places, et cetera. Sometimes you wanted to actually run them through another group. And it was those collisions that created different ways of thinking, different ideas, different relationships. And the same thing goes to applies to sort of universities or schools. You know, collide these people with different backgrounds and good things happen. There are certain places where innovation programs fail within organizations, even enormous global organizations. And one of the things that happens is that when innovation is kept to a smaller team, the expectations and even the demands on them to perform, to produce either new products or efficiencies is intense. And if times are such that there is belt tightening, often those teams will be eliminated. They're not creating any value, at least not any near-term value. They're out. And then all of the institutional knowledge of the discipline of innovation is lost with them. So anyone who knew who the champions were in the organization, where they could go to kind of get new ideas or anything like that, where they could go to get problems. You know, sometimes the issue is what are the business problems that we should be thinking about, that we should be solving? It's a matrix, right? As far as the problems and the solutions and the possible solutions and the mixing together of them, not to mention then the teams and the people who would be impacted by them. So taking a programmatic approach to that is absolutely essential, because on any given day, you might do the right thing. Someone might come in and put together the right team and a good thing might happen. But if you want to do it repeatedly and you want to do it scalably, you have to have a program. And there are lots of different approaches. There's not just one right way to do it. It's not saying, here, you do this one by this author, but rather pick one or pick several and make it, make one that fits the culture of your organization. And then just keep doing it and good things will happen.
One of the things I know you're very fond of is the personality profiling done through the Big Five. Can you explain why that's why it's so valuable, and specifically the Big Five?
This is the era of analytics. We can't get too far away from data and analytics if we're having a conversation. And that leads us right into AI and, NLU, NLP. Natural language processing and understanding. And so one of the things that we're trying to do is we're trying to create predictive models, and we're trying to create them in all kinds of different places. As it turns out, it's very difficult to predict human performance. And we have found over a period of time that we can do something around predicting team performance, very difficult with individuals. A lot of that has to do with understanding an individual's temperament and their motivations. And there are lots of different ways of measuring those things. We've all done Myers-Briggs or colors. There's a lot of them. There's only one that's been actually shown to have value in predictive models, and that is the Big Five. And so at one of the things that really attracted me to what Bala was doing was that he had, he was leveraging Big Five underneath the covers, basically, of the platform, such that as someone uses the platform, their digital exhaust is actually painting a picture of their temperament, of their motivations, of their personality. And so what we are able to do off the back of that is really have a much deeper understanding of that whole person, of that, you know, not just an employee, not just an innovator, but really kind of how they tick and how we can better support that person, because they're all different, right? And so just say, you know, saying they're in this bucket or that bucket isn't helpful. And especially in this age of diversity and inclusion, we want to be able to really understand individuals and how to help individuals. Additionally, it gives us an ability to put together teams that are not based just on competencies. Like that's a project manager, that's a designer, that's a DevOps person. But on top of that, we can also look at how their personalities are likely to mesh. And if I was going to anticipate your question about how do you quantify the value of that, it's just purely think about all of the projects, all of the great innovation projects that have failed over the years that didn't fail because they were not good ideas or relevant ideas, but rather because they had the wrong people working on them at the at the outset. Maybe some of those ideas get brought back later, but maybe they don't. And if they don't, that's something that we think we can fix. For me, coming to innovation was not very circuitous. It was almost instantaneous, and that might have been a function of sort of the things that were happening at the time. But back getting out of school, getting out of a small liberal arts school with a political science and literature background, I ended up in film, of all things. And the film was kind of an interesting time to be in it, because it was undergoing some pretty radical transformation, both in the way that it was edited and also the way that film and video was shot. So without going into too much of the technology, it created some opportunities for small companies that didn't have a lot of investment in the gear of the time to be able to adopt new and different technologies and that were sort of better than and faster and cheaper, et cetera. So that was kind of how I came to innovation in those early days. What it created an opportunity to do was to start my own film company. And so we had one of the first Avid nonlinear editing systems in the country. And so we could cut commercials and we could cut anything, cut movies way faster than other people could. And right then we got into some interactive television test beds with Bell Atlantic and a couple of other big telcos. And that was very interesting. Here we are, you know, some years later, sort of still trying to figure out exactly how the streaming thing should all work. But those were things we did, you know, back then. And it was funny because some of the test stuff we did was the whole concept of minimum viable concept or the minimum viable product. We wanted to know what people were going to do with sort of on-demand video. So the way that it would work is we set up this little fake test set-top box. And you'd push a button and select your movie, but nothing happened digitally because, you know, we didn't have that technology yet. So basically ring a little bell in the back room and someone would shove a VCR, a VHS into the VCR and play that movie. We just wanted to see what people wanted to do. So we did that kind of that voice of customer stuff. Anyway, that company grew into Red Sky Interactive, which was named one of the top 10 digital ad agencies in the country, in the world, actually, by Adweek. Ended up selling that to John Wren at Omnicom, and it ultimately became agency.com, which I think is still going. So that was kind of a cool thing. Right off the back of that transaction, I started two other digital consultancies, design, and both these were a little bit more technology centric. And each of those was acquired as well. I got involved in sort of early days of strangely, using technology to recruit patients for clinical drug trials. So I ended up actually being invited to go speak at the NIH, National Institute of Health, to just talk about how we could use these new emerging tools to try to do something that you know, doctors were really struggling to do, which was to get people signed up for some of these phase three clinical trials. So did that, then ended up joining Unisys as director of global innovation and global business transformation, and was there sort of for 5 years, working with teams all around the world, really mostly helping clients make sense of these emerging technologies so that they could take action and helping them do so. From there, I did a number of things sort of independently and ended up joining a firm called Imaginatic, which was the top ranked innovation management software player in the space, top ranked by Forrester and their Forrester Wave. And it was while I was there that I met Bala, and he was at the time head of HR innovation at LinkedIn. And I was just very impressed with Bala's vision and what he was doing and his HR expertise, because from my perspective, it's always been it's humans that innovate. Tools help and they're great, but it's people. So his focus on whole human and being able to support people and what they were doing was really very impressive to me. So, you know, a couple of years went by and as he was kind of ramping up Innovation Minds, we reconnected and I was able to join him.
Being a filmmaker and then along the way decided to move into more of the space of innovation management and supporting innovation.
I didn't kind of grow up saying, oh, I want to be a filmmaker. I just kind of fell into it. And I fell into it because of the technology side of it. The technology was changing. I was able to take advantage of that change. And we were able to do things that were, you know, extraordinary at the time. And we shot some of the very first digital video with Sony, as a for instance. We made a movie. I mean, we did a lot of cool stuff. But the other thing that's interesting about that is that the economics of the industry changed at the same time. So as I entered commercial making, it was a pretty lucrative business if you knew what you were doing. But with the advent of digital technologies, digital shooting, digital editing, it became available to everyone. There was a democratization, if you will, democratization of filmmaking that really sort of took some of that. That information advantage, that experience advantage away from the established commercial production companies. But at some point I just started looking at the numbers and it was like, hey, you know what? This is not a great business to be in. However, this new emerging digital business is a really interesting business to be in. Let's go do that. And so that was I don't want to say a pivot. It was kind of like just a sort of a veer into doing more and more and more of that. And that's really where my passion lay. It was in sort of these new and different exciting technologies and sort of what they meant for the different industries that we were working with. So not being a technologist, it's really kind of left for me and you know, people like me to try to look at these technologies from a user standpoint. It's like, well, how is this going to be useful? What could we do with that? If you're in innovation, you end up being a systems thinker, and you even end up being a systems of systems thinker. And so what you're doing is you're working with people who are often working in enormous companies with you know, sort of global operations. And they in fact are interested in how these technologies might impact them, both positively or negatively. We talk about disruption a lot, maybe too much. It's kind of an overused concept. But the reality is that it's a real thing. And so, if you're sitting on top of millions, maybe billions of dollars of revenue, you need to be looking over your shoulder at what could be potentially disrupting you. And at the same time, you need to be looking at opportunities that lie in front of you to do new things, different things, you know. And again, maybe those new things for the same, you know, your same customers, or maybe it's new things for new customers. which would be that sort of those moonshot, those Horizon 3 kinds of innovation.
Right. So it's interesting. You've come from a background where you said that getting into innovation was really about your passion for technology, not as a technologist, but just as someone who's, you know, sees the value of it. And yet at the beginning and at the end, it really is about the people.
We've actually regressed. If you think about it, 2000 years ago, your average person knew where all the stars were going to go, you know, at night. They could tell you that's going to go right across there. That's going to go there. They could tell you when the sun was going to rise. They could tell you which of the plants you could eat and which one you couldn't. No one can do any of that stuff anymore. So we are users of technology. We're not, most of us are not makers of technology. But that said, it's we users that drive, you know, sort of necessity is the mother of invention kind of thing. We are the ones that drive the development of the new technology. So when we identify a hole, some technologist will fill it. But as one engineering pal of mine says, you know, given time, I can do anything. He also means budget, but what he's saying is that if you give me the rec and I'll create the product, I'll create the software. It's all of us who are innovators, which is everyone, who actually can see where the holes are, see the problems, see the opportunities, and it's those smart folks that then put together the solutions. Years ago when I was at KPMG, we used to say we would always deliver, right? We always deliver a nice big fat report, and it, you know, usually cost about $1 million, and we deliver it. And used to say no one would read it, but thing about that I always felt was we were always going to give you the answer, but it was often the right answer to the wrong question. So what we do now is we spend a lot of time really working with clients and helping them work with their teams to figure out what are the right questions before we ask anyone their opinion about what the answers are. What are the right questions and why? And so that's at the core of the Innovation Mind solution is basically a challenge where we're looking at the different questions, the different observations, the different holes in the experience out there that maybe need to be filled, and really work on them prior to ever getting to sort of the how might we solve this question that would be the core of an idea challenge. We do that too, but we just don't start with that. We start with the other. The people have to ask the questions. So if you're in an organization where it's only leadership, it's only the people at the top who are asking the questions, then there's no engagement. No one else, you know, people just kind of, they will say what they think that those people want to hear. I mean, this is Emperor's New Clothes stuff. We see it. I mean, we see it every day, right? In the news. We see this kind of groupthink. It's got to be the people who are the rank and file. It's got to be everyone asking the questions. You know, some people say, hey, you know, change is a constant. It's not a constant at all. Change or transformation is inevitable. So we know that, but it's not a constant. It's actually something that is very unevenly distributed. So some industries, some fields are undergoing way more transformational pressure than others. What we can say though is that it's inevitable. So how you know, what are we all going to do about that? Some people ignore it, and we see that all the time. It's just, you know, the laggards, right, in Moore's curve. Most people react to it, and they're like, oh, this is a change. What do I do? And then a few people, like, they really drive it. They are, in fact, the agents of change. And so, they see the value that it can create to create a better world, create a world that's more sustainable, that's more equitable, that all people are in which all people are supported. Those are the people who are, you know, are and can be innovators, but the reality is can be and should be us all. So be that agent of change.
Well, thank you very much, Doug Humphreys.
Thanks so much, Michael. I really appreciate it being here.
This has been At the Edge, a podcast from Innovation Minds. We look forward to hosting you on our next episode, which you can find through the same channel you got here with today. Please join our LinkedIn group where you can discuss every episode. You can find the link in the show notes. We're really glad you were here. And thank you very much from Innovation Minds.